All right, we are continuing our study of the fourth commandment, working through the larger catechism, and it's going to actually kind of work nicely. I have to be honest, I don't plan all these studies, and especially my sermon passages from week to week. It's a matter of just sort of saying how much chunk I can cover, but this will be the last Sunday before I leave for vacation. I'll be gone the next two Sundays, and then when we pick up in the third Sunday when I come back, we're actually going to be looking at a couple of passages, two in particular, that deal with what's referred to as Sabbath controversies. And so this is going to give you some more information, at least from where I'm coming from, when it deals with the whole Sabbath issue that Jesus himself works with the Pharisees in Mark chapter 2. So kind of put this in the back of your mind as end notes or footnotes, however you want to think of it, and that'll come out when we work through the passages in Mark in 3 weeks. Okay, we work through question 117, and I want to return to it. It says, how is the Sabbath, or the Lord's Day, to be sanctified? The Sabbath, or Lord's Day, is to be sanctified by a holy resting all the day, not only from such works as are at all times sinful, but even from such worldly employments and recreations as are on other days lawful, and making it our delight to spend the whole time, except so much of it as is to be taken up in works of necessity and mercy, in the public and private exercises of God's worship. And to that end, we are to prepare our hearts with such foresight, diligence, and moderation to dispose and seasonably dispatch our worldly business, that we may be the more free and fit for the duties of that day. As we think more about this particular question and answer regarding the issue of sanctifying or setting apart the Lord's Day, the divines here basically address it from the standpoint of what we are to, in a sense, desist or stop from doing to set it apart, as well as how we are to proactively pursue certain deeds on that day. And the problem or the difficulty, I think, that we oftentimes run into when we come to this issue of the Lord's Day is we tend to focus more on the negatives, which tends to be the emphasis, especially when you work through the Gospels, that the Pharisees had in looking at all the ways in which they could, at least outwardly, prohibit from transgressing the fourth command. However, that being said, there's obviously a flip side to it as well, a positive and negative side, meaning what you don't do gives you opportunity for what you can do. And so my desire is to help us to see that the benefit of the Lord's Day is not to be looked at from the main angle that the Pharisees had, which obviously Jesus spoke harshly against, because his response to them was that they gave him a greater burden than what was intended. We don't want to see the Lord's Day be a burden. We want to see it be a delight. And that's always been my help in coming to understand, even in a way, what the divines were trying to set forth, and that is making the most of the Lord's Day as it is to our spiritual benefit. Let me read something from a quote. It's actually from a sermon taken from the period of the Reformation. Nevertheless, we have to note that there is more, and that indeed it would be a meager thing to have a rest regarding physical activity but not involving anything else. What is necessary then? That we should strive toward a higher end than this rest here. That we should desist from our works which are able to impede us from meditating on the works of God, from calling upon his name, and from exercising his word. If we turn Sunday into a day of living it up for our sport and pleasure, indeed, how will God be honored in that? Is it not a mockery and even a profanation of his name? Profaning, that's what means profanation. But when shops are closed on Sunday, when people do not travel in the usual way, its purpose is to provide more leisure and liberty for attending to what God commands us, that we might be taught by his word, that we might convene together in order to confess our faith, to invoke his name, and to participate in the use of the sacrament. That is the end for which this order must serve us. Moreover, let us realize that it is not only for coming to the sermon that the day of Sunday is instituted. but in order that we might devote all the rest of time to praising God. On other days, seeing that we are so occupied with our affairs, we are not as much open to serve God as on a day which is totally dedicated to this. Thus, we ought to observe Sunday in a way in which we are neither impeded by nor occupied with anything else, so that we might be able to extend all our senses to recognize the benefits and favors with which He has enlarged us. Thus, when people profane the holy order which God has instituted to lead us to Himself, why should they be astonished if all the rest of the week is this degraded? Now, guess who said that? It's actually Calvin. And my point was, you know, again, I've always told you there's two sides when it comes to the Reformed view. The continental, which is represented by Calvin, and the more staunch Puritan view. But as I said, you listen to Calvin, practically speaking, he doesn't sound that much different, does he? I mean, he doesn't. I mean, that's a sermon that he preached on the fourth commandment. There is a very clear theological difference, undoubtedly. I mean, that I won't disagree, because Calvin's theological view of the fourth commandment was definitely different from the Puritan view. But when it came to the practice of it and the delight of it, it rarely looked different. It really did. That's my point, is to say, don't look at it from this difference and then try to separate again. Okay, we can't do this, we can't do this. I mean, my point is, if we come to the fourth commandment as a delight, even as Calvin expounds it here, there's plenty to do. There's plenty to do. The main emphasis should not be on restrictions. And as soon as we start talking about what we can't do, then we're missing out on the joy and the delight that it does provide. Now, but even saying that, you know, sin creeps in delight. There's no doubt about it. The things that we enjoy oftentimes can easily turn to sin. So there's a guard against that. Well, I have to be fair to Calvin. This is only a section of the sermon, you know, like anything. It's, you know, you take somebody in his quote. But my point was saying that was, again, practically speaking, the continentalists, or the view that Calvin and the continental reformers held, when it came to practice, didn't look all that different. Their theological differences were very much noticeable, because how they viewed the fourth commandment as mainly being part of the ceremonial law, that was a big divide, which the others didn't have. So there's a significant theological and exegetical difference that they held to. But when it came to practice, what they both focused on is, as you said, the Sabbath was made for man. But what part of man? They would say it would be the man's soul and his delighting in the Lord that was unique to the Lord's day. Not that every other day wasn't, but the Lord's day. Because if you take the premise as you do, if the Lord's day is primarily for the worship of God's people, for Him, you want to add to that in ways that you're limited by necessity of working the other 6 days that we ought to in enjoying the spiritual benefits that the Lord's Day affords us, that God set apart. Because, I mean, the word Sabbath means simply rest. That's what the word Sabbath is. It's Shabbat, which is the Hebrew word for rest. Now, as the command, it's not rest from everything. I disagree with, practically speaking, Sunday shouldn't be a day where you just sleep all afternoon. That's idleness. Does not conform to delighting in the Lord when you just sleep all day. And some people think of Sunday simply as a physical rest. It's rest from your daily labors and setting apart a day of delighting in the spiritual riches that God gives to us. Because if you go through, especially the book of Hebrews chapter 4, it talks about there remaining for us an eternal Sabbath or an everlasting rest, which is a picture of what? Exactly. That new heavens and the new earth is an eternal Sabbath. We'll no longer have to work the way we work here. We'll no longer experience fatigue, pain, no more tears, no more crying. All of that is part of the new heavens and the new earth. And it's going to be forever. And what God has done, I see it in His condescension to us of saying, take 1 day in 7 just to give your heart's affections to that. Long for it. Not in just the corporate assembly of God's people when it comes to corporate worship, but look at it from the perspective of this is a foretaste of heaven. The Lord's Day should be a foretaste of heaven, looking towards the eternal rest. So I use that as my principle of what will heaven be like? What will we enjoy in heaven? We're going to enjoy God in a way that we wouldn't enjoy God here, even on earth. And I think that's another aspect of it is if there's an aspect of our delighting in God on the Lord's Day that's a part of this age, then that may be missing the mark. Does that make sense? if our delighting in the Lord is on this day, in the earthly Sabbath, or the earthly Lord's Day, something that's not going to be a part of the eternal rest, then there may be a disconnect there. We'll be eating and drinking, but we'll be eating and drinking with all of God's people. If there's a exclusivity or some manner in which we don't fellowship on the Lord's Day, the way it's depicting the new heavens and new earth, we're missing something there. We're getting part of it, but not all. Literally, the new heavens and new earth, it's not like there's going to be this, I can't imagine a table large enough to fit every believer that's going to be up there. I mean, it's going to be broken up, I'm sure, into some setting where, you know, like even Jesus says, somebody's going to be sitting next to Jesus left and right, not everybody. I mean, somebody's going to be closer to Jesus than others. When James and John were arguing about that, Jesus made it very clear. It's not for you. Your whole attitude shows that you're not ready to sit at my left or sit at my right. So I think the emphasis that the divines, practically speaking, is trying to point out is moving towards exercising and contemplating the Lord's Day as something that is making us long for heaven. It's that simple. Do we want heaven more, the new heavens and the new earth, than we want what's here now, what's on the earth? And if our life pattern gives more evidence to we enjoy the things of this life more than we are anxiously expecting and longing for what God has promised in Christ for the new heavens and the new earth, then again, I would say there's a disconnect. We're not appreciating, we're not delighting, we're not benefiting in what God has designed in terms of what the eternal Sabbath should be. And so with that in mind, this is kind of where the divines, I believe, are coming from. And I think there's a spectrum of Puritan mindset. I mean, just like any group of people, we can easily kind of pinpoint or get focused in on one subset. There's a book written by Philip Ryken called Worldly Saints, a subtitle, something to the effect of who the true Puritans were. And I would commend that book to you because unlike a lot of the caricaturizations of Puritanism that's been popularized, that book helps to kind of see Puritanism and Puritans in a light that's more, I think, realistic and broader than what's typically presented of the Puritans. And even among the Puritans, there was a broad spectrum of them. I think their zeal came out of their eschatology because they came, especially the New England Puritans, they came to America thinking that that was going to be the age of the millennium. And so they established a society that in their mind looked a lot like what they envisioned the eschaton to be. There's a little parenthesis here that I want us to kind of work through because this is where some of it we're going to see in Mark, but it gets fleshed out more. They talk about making it our delight to spend the whole time, except so much of it as it is to be taken up in works of necessity and mercy. Those are sort of little catchphrases that's oftentimes borrowed from the confession to describe what then are expressions of, quote, labor or works that are permissible and, in fact, encouraged on the Lord's Day. And this comes into play, of course, in Mark's account. We'll see in a couple of weeks about him healing. He'll heal on the Sabbath, as well as he and his disciples will eat. And they'll be accused of gleaning from the field on that day. And so, even as Jesus, who is the Lord of the Sabbath, made clear the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so, the point that the divines are making here, in terms of works of necessity and mercy, would fall into the category of things that we do, not because it provides for us income or other financial benefits, but what is, in essence, just necessary for life. Now, the problem with that is that was more clear, probably in an age where technology doesn't or hasn't, in that period, advanced to where we are today. So, like with anything that's man-made, you got to be careful how to, you know, what is works of necessity? What Jesus would imply there, at least in the Mark passage, is eating. And if they can take grain and rub it in and use it to consume it for food, you know, people would say that was working. Or at least that's what the Pharisees said. They were working. They were reaping the grain on that day. Well, Jesus made it very clear. That's not a command. There's not a command in the Bible that says you can't eat. And you can't even do what's necessary to eat. But again, the Pharisees added to the law just to keep it simple for themselves. And so that became one expression of actually laboring, of reaping on the Sabbath day. But take that into consideration today. What are works of necessity? And that gets a whole lot more complicated, of course. If it deals with your common labor, that would fall into the category, as it's even stated in the part of the commandment, 6 days thou shalt labor and do thy work, or do thy labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath, or the rest of the Lord thy God. And so works of necessity would fall into the category of things that aren't necessarily evil, or that which relates to your vocation, your secular vocation, or your calling, that you can easily desist from on that day. That's the category, it's works of mercy, where you're actually helping people in need. So that's the other category that Jesus was referring to when he healed a man on the Sabbath. And he asked the question, is it wrong to heal or to do good on the Sabbath? So that's a general category of doing good. And I think it goes to show, like even Kenny, you work in an industry that doesn't stop. Electric companies don't shut down after 5 o'clock. They keep their factories running. So I can see that being a work of necessity. You can't tell the people that they're supplying, sorry, we're not going to have electricity after 6 o'clock today. You just have to use your candles and do whatever you need to until 8 o'clock and we'll run the factory again. That's where it gets real complicated. It really does. In a society where you have all these different industries, you got to be careful to be quick to judge. You really do. Even within the medical profession, there are different occupations you can take. I have a friend who's a family physician. And he's able to operate a schedule a whole lot more than somebody like you who's working for the hospital. So they're going to dictate your schedule. And again, for him, and being more of a family practitioner, he makes a diligent effort to schedule his patients and even his visits on Sunday, unless it's something absolutely necessary, he doesn't do it because he wants to be able to be as regular as possible in church on Sunday. So it's a matter of the attitude and making it more than just a simple question of can or cannot. I don't think anybody asks us, do we want to eat? We don't ask, do we want lunch? Of course we want lunch. You need food to survive. It's not a matter of, do I want food? You want food. And it's not exact parallel, but when it comes to the Lord's Day, if you don't see the Lord's Day as food for your soul, then that's where the missing link is. We ought to want the Lord's Day diligently. It's something we ought to strive for, not just sort of stumble across and not just say, okay, it's here. That's the analogy of foretaste of heaven. And I think by and large, that's a problem of Americans and people who live in a prosperous society, by and large. How is heaven really going to be that much better? I know we don't say that, but unless you're sick, unless you're down and out, this world looks pretty good. It's a blessing, but no blessing here on earth should dim the glory that is to come. But in the process, that ought not to make us long for the fulfillment. As Paul talks about, even creation groans for the adoption of sons. I don't know about groaning, but that's a birth pain analogy. I think women want to have that baby out as soon as possible. They're not delighting in that groaning as they're working through that delivery process. And I think that's the difference. If our hearts are not on longing for more, but only content with what is, then we're no different. The pagan can feast and party all day long. And I think in the feasting, if our heart doesn't turn to, there's more to come. And it's going to be so much better. It's going to be so much better than what it is now. Then we are becoming settled on just the temporal blessing and not the true blessing, who is Christ. He's the blessing. And everything good comes from him. And so we don't want to get caught up in the now and miss what is to come. That is the picture of the New Testament. And I think, again, for most of us who live in America, we don't know anything of persecution, hardly. The greatest persecution we can get now, maybe, is the government telling us how we're going to have to serve certain people or provide insurance for certain people that we don't want. The persecution that we experience here just dims in comparison to what Paul and the early Christians experienced, so that they definitely had a longing for glory. And physically, yes, their life was much harder. Most of them probably didn't live past 45. Life expectancy was much shorter. With long-term life, as we have it today, based on medical assistance and whatnot, that extends more complicated situations as much as it does make life healthier. It's a both and versus just seeing it as altogether a plus or benefit without the challenges that come along with it. Okay, let's move on then to the next question, because this is interesting. Why is the charge of keeping the Sabbath more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors? And this is going to be an overlap, actually, to some degree, with the next command, which deals with honoring your father and your mother. The charge of keeping the Sabbath is more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors, because they are bound not only to keep it themselves, but to see that it be observed by all those that are under their charge, and because they are prone oftentimes to hinder them by employments of their own. That's why when the commandment is mentioned, it also speaks about, thou shalt not do any works, thou, thy sons, thy daughters, thy manservant, maidservant, cattle, and so on. So it goes to include not just the individual, but especially even in the day when the commandment was given, you had not just the Israelites, but you had, in fact, Egyptians and other foreigners who had come along with the Israelites. And of course, God was looking to the day when they would have conquered, especially the land of promise, and probably taken on slaves and other prisoners of war, if you will, afterwards. And they would come under servanthood. And you also had indentured servanthood. That was a common practice in that day as well. And so the whole idea is not just a rest for the privileged. It's not just a rest for those who have access to that blessing, but it would be a blessing to the whole people of God, who are under, I would use the expression, covenant blessing. People of Israel were unique in their observance of the Lord's Day and the Sabbath in the Old Testament from all the other nations. If something stood out visibly from a historical period, was the Israelites keeping as poorly and as even wrongly as they might have, still in a visible sense was a clear presentation to all the world, these people are different. These people are indeed set apart in a way that, you know, obviously pagans couldn't understand, because their God didn't give them that kind of blessing. They worked as hard as they could because they were dependent upon their hands. Whatever they did, they earned. So you see the contrast of grace and dependence that the people of God were given by the Lord's Day versus all the other nations who worshiped false gods and really were no gods. And so they were ultimately reliant on the work of their own hands. And so, and even before the Ten Commandments are given, God prescribed for them how they would collect the manna. On the sixth day, they would collect a double portion, so they wouldn't have to on the seventh day. And so even before the prescription of the fourth commandment, that practice was even being rehearsed for the people of God as they came to Mount Sinai. And so God is looking at this not just as a benefit for the people who have, but really this benefit cut across everybody that were under the blessing of God as the people of Israel. It was a picture of God's wide open grace, even to foreigners and those who may not have had as privileged status in society. And so he was urging those who had such authorities to extend that blessing to everyone that they had the opportunity to do so. Okay, let's wrap it up here. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you again for allowing us to think more deeply and to consider all the riches that you have given to us in Christ, even through the Lord's Day, that is a gift to us. Help us to look with greater fervency of how we might enjoy and delight in you, and to long for that which you have promised would be ours one day in the new heavens and the new earth. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.